Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state and our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, very special guest, Tennessee State Senator Jack Johnson. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Senate Majority Leader Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson grew up in a small town in Texas, but proudly calls Middle Tennessee home since graduating from Texas State University with a degree in education. Jack and his wife, Deanna, the circuit court judge for the 21st Judicial District, are raising their three children in Franklin. Jack and Deanna met over 30 years ago at a Young Republican function, sharing the same conservative values and the same dream of a future filled with faith and family. Jack was first elected to the Tennessee State Senate in 2006. Since his first day in office, he has proudly represented Tennesseans' conservative values. Jack knows that conservative values are Tennessee values, which is why he always fights to lower taxes, defend constitutional rights, secure our southern border, protect our most vulnerable, and ensure parents always have a voice in their children's education. Jack was proud to cast his first vote in the Senate for the first Republican lieutenant governor in 140 years. After only 2 years, he was appointed as chairman of the Government Operations Committee. A year later, he was named chairman of the Commerce and Labor Committee. He served as Commerce Committee Chairman for 9 years until December of 2018, when he was elected by his Republican colleagues as the Senate Majority Leader. Jack Johnson has over 20 years of hands-on experience in the financial industry. Jack serves as the Senior Vice President for Studio Bank in the Cool Springs area. Senator Johnson represents the 27th District, which includes most of Williamson County. When the day's work is done, Jack enjoys spending time with his family and playing guitar. That I would love to hear. Hello, Senator. How are you today?
I'm great, Steve. It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Where can we hear you play some guitar?
Well, if you're a real glutton for punishment, we play out in Leaper's Fork every once in a while, and it's purely for fun. It's only a hobby. There was a time many years ago when I thought I might try to make a living doing that, and quickly figured out that's probably not a good career path for me.
Yeah, well, I hear Nashville is the place to do that if you ever were going to change careers. But we really appreciate you taking time to come on here. You guys and gals have been very busy up there in Nashville this session with some important bills getting done. What are you most happy with?
Well, you know, we started off the session with two very important bills that I felt we needed to pass here in Tennessee. I was proud that the very first bill filed for the 113th General Assembly, Senate Bill 1, was a bill that would prevent transgender operations, surgeries, and medicinal procedures on kids that could be life-altering, permanent changes to their bodies based on their gender identity. As you know, and anybody that's been following in the news knows that there are states that are doing this. They give it this awful euphemism of gender affirming care, but really, I think it's more mutilation of kids. You know, we've all been through puberty, and for some, it's more difficult than others. Going through adolescence can be a difficult time. Your hormones are raging, and your body's changing, and your emotions are running high, and in some cases, kids think that perhaps they are, they're trapped in the wrong genders in terms of their body. Most people grow out of that whenever they have that kind of an identity crisis. So the last thing we need to be doing is performing surgeries or prescribing medicines that will permanently alter a child's body. Now, once you're an adult, once you turn 18 in Tennessee, you're recognized as an adult. And if you wish to pursue that, that's your business. So I was very proud to sponsor that legislation, get it passed. The governor signed it. It is now against the law in Tennessee to do that. The other bill has to deal with obscene entertainment in front of kids. We've seen this in various parts of the country and even right here in Tennessee, where so-called family-friendly drag shows were anything but family-friendly and, in fact, were obscene, pornographic even. And so I filed legislation that would prevent that from happening in Tennessee. So those are two things that I was very proud of. Lots of other things we can talk about, but those were two priorities of mine coming into this session.
Great. I wanted to hear exactly that. And there are a lot of age inappropriate things going on. We'll discuss that in a little later on here. But 80,000 people like me, actually, have moved to Tennessee in the last year, the most in state history. And it's mainly because we are the reddest of red states. Out of 99 assembly seats, 75 are Republican, only 24 are Dems, one independent. The Dems could rent an RV and flee to Denver to avoid a vote, and you'd still have quorum. So, you know, no real reason to compromise with them. Is there anything they are asking for that you'd be willing to give them?
No, not really. I mean, you know, a lot of the bills that we address up here don't necessarily fall along partisan lines. Most bills that we take up on the Senate floor when we vote on them as a body pass with overwhelming support, bipartisan support, because, again, they're more just nuts and bolts government type things. But when things do fall along partisan lines, you're right. For example, Senate Bill 1 that I just talked about, and then Senate Bill 3 that I talked about, I believe those were both votes that fell along party lines. So, no, we're not going to allow our friends on the other side of the aisle to advance any kind of a leftist agenda in Tennessee.
Okay. Well, Governor Lee, Speaker Cameron Sexton, and you, sir, deserve credit for a great job of creating that environment for American Republicanism to flourish. The theme of this show, all the way back to when it was in the blue state of Washington, you don't know that, but that's where its origins are, has always been, what is a Republican? In Washington, it made no sense. Here, it does. In your words, what is a Republican? What does a Republican believe? And what does a Republican do?
Well, I think you have to start with the party platform. That's kind of our guiding document, if you will, as a party, although even with that document, you'll find disagreement among some Republicans. For me personally, it starts with my faith. I'm informed by my faith, and it guides everything I do. Not that I'm successful. I fail every single day, and most of us who try to follow Christ do fail, but we keep trying. And with his blessing and grace, we get to wake up every day and start again. And so, you know, I kind of break things into silos. I look at fiscal policy, regulatory policy, and then I look on what some might refer to as more the social side. On the social side, I believe life begins at conception. That's something from which I do not waver. And I'm proud to say that I believe Tennessee is now the safest place in America to be an unborn child. And that's a core conviction of mine and something we've fought for many years. And I, like many pro-life people, I was thrilled with the Dobbs decision. And we had a trigger law in place that has now become law that protects unborn children. You know, I certainly believe in family values and parental rights, you know, things that in Tennessee, I want people who come to Tennessee to be able to raise their children in a manner that they deem appropriate. I believe in the Second Amendment, and I believe that's a fundamental right that we have. It's given to us by God, not by government, but it is government's right duty to protect that right that is endowed by our Creator. On the fiscal side, you know, again, you don't have to take my word for it. The numbers don't lie. We're the least indebted state in the nation. We're the lowest tax state per capita in the nation. We have AAA credit ratings from all the ratings agencies. Our pension plan is fully funded. We have massive reserves put away in our rainy day fund. We have a constitutional requirement to balance our budget every year, and we do that, and we do it legitimately. Some states have that requirement, but they play monkey business and play accounting games to try to say that their budget's balanced when really it's not, but we don't in Tennessee. And so we, every year since Republicans took over, which by the way is an interesting historical note that a lot of folks that you probably know this, but some folks that are just moving to Tennessee don't realize, Republicans have controlled this state for 12 years.
Right.
That's when I first got elected, Democrats controlled, you know, they had the governor's office, they had a majority in the House and the Senate. My very first General Assembly, there were 16 Republicans, 16 Democrats, and one independent. It wasn't until January of 2000, with the inauguration of Bill Haslam as governor, that we truly took control of our state and had sizable, significant majorities in both the House, the Senate, and had the governor's office. So since that time, when you look at what we've accomplished in this state in terms of cutting taxes, creating, I think, the most business-friendly economic climate in the nation, the numbers don't lie. And as you said, people are moving here for that. I think that's the way our framers intended for it to be, for states to be laboratories of democracy. And if California, if they want to just continue to raise taxes and regulate people and drive businesses out, more power to them. But states like Tennessee, Texas, Florida are going to continue to benefit from that. So, you know, it's a big question, but those are some of the things that are important to me.
Good. Republicans are traditionally pro-business in the sense of allowing free market capitalism to best deliver goods and services in exchange for a mutually agreed to price between two private parties without government interference. However, there has been an alarming shift in this model where business is increasingly exercising its power to dictate terms within the marketplace, sometimes with government assistance, all at the expense of individual rights. Nationwide, of course, and of course, Tennessee is part of that. An example is a conglomerate of tech companies that drove Parler from the marketplace due to a nebulous disinformation claim. Then the federal government attempted to set up a disinformation board to validate the suppression. How does the Tennessee Republican Party balance the rights of the citizens who elect them with the business interests who may be oppressing those same citizens?
Well, I think you have to recognize all rights, and certainly we start with individual rights, as I said, as guaranteed by, as endowed by our Creator, protected by our Bill of Rights and our Constitution, both at the state and the federal level. So you certainly start there with individual rights and individual freedoms. But businesses are important. They create our jobs. They generate the revenue that runs our state and most of our local communities. And so we want a free market economy with as little government intervention as possible. As you said in your introduction, before I became majority leader, I was chairman of our Commerce and Labor Committee for 9 years. And we worked very hard. And that was just as Republicans were taking control, so we could actually get some things done. So we did things like reform our workers' compensation system to make it fairer and put less money in the pockets of trial lawyers and more money in the pockets of truly injured workers, and to eliminate fraud and abuse. We reformed our unemployment compensation system because that's an important system. If someone loses their job and it's not for any fault of their own, we do have a system that provides some assistance for them. So, and then you get into the regulatory side in terms of, you know, how much is a state dictating how a business runs its business? And several important things. We're a right-to-work state. We just affirmed that in our Constitution. We are an at-will employment state, which is critically important. So you measure all of those different things because we want to respect and protect people's individual rights, but we also want them to be able to get a good job. And we've created a system now, an economy in Tennessee, we have more jobs than we have people to fill them. And we have some people that probably should be going to work and they're not going to work. But that's why we're spending so much time thinking about education and creating a qualified workforce, because our economy is so strong in Tennessee. We're really struggling. I hear from people every day about the opportunity to try to find employees.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'd love to ask you, while I have you, some inside baseball on the session that's been going on right now. The first thing that I hear questions out there from listeners that are interested is, why did we dissolve the Commission on Children and Youth amid the foster care woes?
Well, we have had some significant issues with our Department of Children's Services, and we've been working on that for the last several years, and I think we're going to make some significant strides in that regard as well. The Tennessee Commission on Children and Youth, I don't believe represents the values of Tennessee, and they have since scrubbed their website, but a few days ago, you could have gone to their website and seen all of their promotion about LGBTQ information, transgender, even talking about gender affirming care, as we talked about a few moments ago. And so they have been overtly political, and that's not why they were created back when Senator Doug Henry created them back in the 80s or whenever it was a long time ago. I have no issue with having an oversight entity. I think that that's probably a good idea, but they should not have a political agenda. And the Tennessee Commission on Children and Youth has had a leftist political agenda in the eyes of many members of the General Assembly. So as you're probably aware, we rolled that bill till next year, and I think we're going to have some good conversations over the summer, and perhaps we can reconstitute that entity, or perhaps I think the governor would have preferred we just dissolve it and take the responsibilities of that organization and reassign them to other departments. So we're going to continue that. I think the House is going to pass the bill that the governor proposed, but I did defer action on it because of some of the concerns that were raised, and so we'll talk about it over the summer and maybe revisit it in January.
Makes sense. Okay. Also, a Tennessee bill that redefines definition of money is kind of freaking people out, paves the way for a global currency, passed the Senate, I believe, and heads to the House floor.
Okay, well, it does no such thing. I'm going
Great.
to interject there
Great.
with you. It does no such thing relative to, and let me first of all say, I think we would probably be in agreement, and most people that are aligned with us philosophically would be in agreement that we don't need any type of central bank digital currency. We don't need any type of governmental mandated currency that can be turned on and off by the government. We don't need a situation in the United States where similar to what they had happen in Canada with regards to the truckers, when they just shut down their credit cards and stopped their ability, they impeded the access to their own money. And so I'm in full complete agreement about that. Unfortunately, though, there's tremendous amount of misinformation out, and that's the world we live in. You've got anybody, you know, that can go and open up a Twitter account or talk about issues and lie about issues or misrepresent issues, and sometimes for no other purpose than to just make people mad and possibly raise money. And so that's the world I'm in, is I spend a lot of time, and that's why I'm grateful to be on here with you to set the record straight.
Yes, please.
Bill that that I think gave some people some heartburn is, we refer to it as the money transmitter bill, is a badly needed bill. And ironically, if we didn't pass it, and we did pass it, then we set ourselves up for the federal government to come in and control this space. And I don't want the federal government taking control of anything anymore. They're already far too powerful and far too involved in our daily lives. And you know, I'm a big 10th Amendment state sovereignty guy. But that's a different conversation. But this particular bill simply deals with money transmitters. Now, you may be old enough, I certainly am, to remember that in the old days when you transmitted money, you went to Western Union. And you'd hand them your money and they would wire it to a different location. And whoever you're wiring it to, they'd go pick it up. Well, now you pick up one of these things and you hit a couple of buttons and you're sending hundreds of dollars to your kids or to whoever, a friend, via Venmo or Zelle or Cash App. And some of these entities have very, very little regulation on them. And so our commissioner of banking, Greg Gonzalez, brought this bill, and he's worked with other state commissioners, state level regulators, to come up with legislation that states could pass to make sure that the companies that are doing this, that they have a bond, that they're licensed and, you know, have some reason. I'm not anti any regulation. We need reasonable regulation. So that's what the bill does. There was one line in there that dealt with, and I'm sorry, I don't have it right in front of me, but it dealt with currency that's recognized by more than one government. We had to put that in there because you have the euro, which, you know, is used by more than one country. But here's what we did, and actually my friend William Lamberth did this, and it seems to allay some of the concerns, especially relative to CBDC. He had the Beacon Center, who is a very well-respected think tank, nonpartisan, but they're very free market and I think would be aligned on a lot of issues with us. Leader Lamberth had them review this bill to see, is there anything in here that's going to facilitate or create an environment where central bank digital currency could advance? And they came back and said, absolutely not. Now, there is a different bill, and this is the bill that Governor Noem in South Dakota vetoed. And it's we call it the UCC bill. It deals with the Uniform Commercial Code. And there was some concern with some language in that particular bill, and we have deferred action on it. We're not going to pass that. So anyway, misinformation. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to set the record straight. But
yeah, I'm thrilled that you're on here to do that. So thank you.
The money transmitter bill that I've seen a lot of stuff on social media about people talking about it is a fine bill and a needed bill, unless you want the federal government coming in and taking control of that industry.
Okay. Well, you have well over 3,000 individual pieces of legislation to consider, and it's been 45 days of the session. The Tennessee General Assembly has opted to pause consideration on several of them until 2024. I won't run through all 3,000 with you today to try to, you know, get your thoughts and insights, but I would like to get your thoughts on some of them. For example, SB 596, Senate Judiciary Committee's deferred a bill that would protect officiants from being forced to perform wedding ceremonies until next year. What's going to change between now and then that you couldn't handle that one now?
Well, I'm supportive of that legislation. And I believe Senator Mark Pote, my friend from Wilson County, is the sponsor of that. And it would simply say that if for some reason you have a religious or personal objection to, let's say, same-sex marriage, and you were asked by a same-sex couple to solemnize their wedding, is the term that the legal term that's used in the code, that you would not have to do that
as in solemnly swear, right?
Right, exactly. And I think that's a good bill. I think if whether you agree or disagree with the legality of same-sex marriage, unfortunately, with the Obergefell decision, they overturned what a lot of states, including us, had set in our constitution. We passed a constitutional amendment affirming that marriage is a sacred union between one man and one woman. But that was overturned, and that was thrown out with the Obergefell decision. So there are plenty of folks out there that will perform a same-sex wedding. You shouldn't force someone who has an objection to doing that to do it.
I agree. SB 755, Education Savings Account Pilot Program, was passed with a 20-6 vote. That's overwhelming. What will that mean for kids?
Well, I'm a strong proponent of school choice, and I was proud to sponsor the legislation in 2019. That was the first year that Governor Lee was in office, and my first year as majority leader, and as I carry the governor's legislation, we passed school choice. We've been trying to pass it in some form or fashion for many years up here and had been unable to do it. We did get it passed. It was limited. I would prefer something more broad, but it's what we could get passed. And in fact, in the House in 2019, it passed by one vote,
Wow.
even being limited to just Davidson and Shelby counties, which is where we have the highest concentration of failing schools. So it made sense if you're going to initiate a plan that's going to give parents school choice for their kids, that it be in the areas where it's most badly needed. So that did go into effect now, and then after it was passed, it was enjoined. There was pending litigation that finally worked its way through the courts. The law was allowed to stand and was able to, we were able to start implementing that and start handing out these education savings account dollars to kids in Davidson and Shelby counties with this current school year starting back in the fall. I expect that to grow, and you can look at other states, and we've looked at some of their models, and they've been quite successful. But already this year, even just the first year of implementation, Senator Todd Gardenhire brought a bill and expanded it to Hamilton County. So now we've added another county, and I think you'll hear more conversations about school choice. And I think it's not going to be a panacea. It's not going to solve our educational issues, but I think it's a critical piece of that. And certainly, where you have kids in failing schools, parents need to have an option.
Okay. Speaker Sexton is talking about rejecting federal education funding. What would that mean?
So it's something we need to do, and I touched on this a moment ago. The federal government has grown far beyond what the framers intended for it to be. I believe that, and as someone who serves in state government, I'm frustrated by that, and become more and more frustrated. Under the Trump administration, we saw that revert a little bit. The Trump administration loosened some of the strings tied to federal money and gave us a greater amount of flexibility. We were able to get a TennCare block grant waiver, which is our Medicaid program, and we're able to have a lot more flexibility with that program. With regards to the federal department, first of all, there shouldn't be a federal Department of Education. That was created under the Carter administration back in the 70s. And the federal government has no role whatsoever in education. There should be no money involved. There should be no requirements, no strings, no anything from the federal government. Unfortunately, though, it does exist, and there is money that comes to Tennessee and other states as well. We get about $1.8 billion. I think that we should just say no to the money and say we don't want the federal government involved in any way whatsoever in Tennessee education. Now, we have to, though, if we're serious about doing that, we have to figure out where's that 1.8 going? Is it needed? How much of it is being spent on stuff that we don't need to be doing anyway? And what would be the real net effect fiscally? And here's the thing. I've told you my position, but I always like to make sure you understand that $1.8 billion, that's your money. Okay, that's money that you're paying in federal taxes to the federal government, and then it comes back to us. So when we just say we don't want that money, which I think we should do, but we are relinquishing that, and that money's just going to go to California or New York or whatever. And whether it's our tax money, or considering our federal government is running massive deficits and continues, they're borrowing the money from our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. So with that caveat, though, I think in this particular instance, we should say no to that money. But it's a big chunk. I mean, that's $1.8 billion. And so what the speaker has decided to do, and where I think the legislation is, is that we are going to set up that task force to look at exactly what is that money going to, what are we spending it on, how much of it we don't need to do anyway, and so what would be that real fiscal impact to Tennessee. So I'm excited, and I hope more states begin to do that. And if you couple that with electing, you know, a true conservative president next year in 2024, who will go back to what President Trump was doing in terms of restoring some of those 10th Amendment state sovereignty rights, I think that'd be a great 1-2 punch.
I think so too. And the strings attached to that money is usually more expensive than the actual dollars that trickle down to the kids, which it usually doesn't. Another bill being pushed by Speaker Sexton creates two very different kinds of charter schools from the state's homeschool community. House Bill 1214 and its companion in the Senate for you, 1194, quote, "It threatens to significantly blur the lines between public charter schools and homeschools." A lot of phone calls coming in on that one, and a bill to limit class sizes failed in the House too. Only, you know, one out of three kids can read at grade level here. Something has to change if we want them to learn. When you look at the harmful practices that the Tennessee government is banning, does it even make sense public is where parents should send their kids?
Well, 85% of our kids go to public schools. So even with a robust school choice program, and I'm a big fan of homeschooling, I got a lot of homeschoolers in Williamson County, and they do an amazing job. But still, we're going to have public schools. At least if you want to get away from any type of public school, that's going to take a long time to get done. So we need to focus on improving our public schools. I'm a fan of charter schools, and we should have more of them because they can think outside of the box and do some unique things in communities that are right for those particular kids. But we need to protect our homeschoolers as well. And I've received some of the calls, as you mentioned, and they have been coming in. And I don't want to do anything. And I think it is right for parents of homeschoolers and those who support the homeschooling community to be very nervous about anything that puts any additional state governance over how they homeschool. That's why parents want to homeschool, is so that they don't have to deal with those things. So it's not my bill. I am following it and monitoring it. And I know a number of my colleagues have had some of the same conversations. But there are other things in that bill that I think we do need to look at. And one of those is more of a boarding type of charter school. Mm. You know, this kind of ties into what we're talking about with DCS. And, you know, our foster care program, and sadly, you know, we've got kids that have to go into state custody because they're in an abusive and neglectful situation at home. And that's a very painful thing to think about, but it does happen. And so we have wonderful foster families. You know, we're making some changes in our DCS program so that they'll be better equipped to take care of these kids. And what I think, Speaker, I'm not speaking for Speaker Sexton, as I understand one of the things he wants us to consider is perhaps we could have a boarding type of charter school where kids live there. You know, they eat there, sleep there. You know, a lot I didn't, but I know folks that their parents sent them to boarding school, and you could have that kind of a situation. But again, back to the homeschooling concern, I'm very cognizant of that, and again, I don't want government doing anything that's going to impede on a parent's ability to homeschool their kids.
Okay. This is an easy one. SB 1125 increases the maximum speed limit on controlled access state and interstate highways with four or more lanes to 75 miles per hour from 70 miles per hour. I happen to know some insurance specialists, and I was told that about one in four motorists aren't insured in the state of Tennessee. It's an oddity, but it exists. And then, of course, toll roads are being proposed. What do you think of that situation?
Well, on the speed limit, I drive I-65 from Franklin to Nashville frequently, and that's a four-lane interstate. There's nobody driving 70 miles an hour, I'll tell you that. If you are, you better be in the far right lane or you're going to get run off the road, I think. So I have no problem with that. I am from Texas. I have family in Texas. I was down there not long ago and doing some traveling around the state. They have places where it's 80. 80 miles an hour. Now it's flat and it's, you know, more straight kind of things. We have more mountains and hills and turns and that type of thing. So I have no issue with that. I'm going to correct you on one thing. No one has proposed toll roads for the state of Tennessee. And it's a very important distinction because I'm not a fan of toll roads. I'm not a fan of building a facility that you have to pay to drive on. And that has not been proposed. What has been proposed is to add existing capacity to some of our most congested areas, existing interstate roadways, typically around urban areas. I use I-24 from Murfreesboro to Nashville. Anybody in Middle Tennessee knows that that is a nightmare from a congestion standpoint. But to add capacity to that facility, say a lane each way, could very much be $1 billion. And when you add up every road project we need done in the state right now, it's $26 billion in today's dollars. We have about $500 million a year to spend on that. So do the math. That's the problem that we face. Now, there's several ways we could fix that. We could raise taxes. We could raise the gas tax or some other tax. We're not going to do that. We're not going to do that in Tennessee.
Please no.
We could take on a bunch of debt. We could issue a bunch of bonds. But today, we're one of, I think it's five states in the nation that we owe zero money on our roads. We have no bonded indebtedness on our roads in Tennessee. It's one of the reasons we are the least indebted state in the nation, and I don't want to change that. So what are you going to do? I mean, what is going to be the fix for $26 billion in projects that need to be done and $500 million a year to spend on them? Well, what the governor's proposed, some of those most expensive projects are on some of those interstate facilities, and you can add capacity via public-private partnership. And guess what? A fancy conservative principle here. Let the people who are utilizing the service pay for it and make it a choice lane. No one has to drive in that lane and pay to drive in it. All the lanes that are there now will still be there, and those are paid for by your gas tax money and my gas tax money that we pay into the system. But if you can get several billion dollars worth of projects done in the most badly needed congested areas and not have to raise taxes, not have to borrow money, and get them done and let the people that use it and drive it every day pay for it, that's a conservative principle. I ran as a conservative, and I believe that making people who utilize a governmental service, making them pay for it, is the best way to deliver government. So I'm a fan, and I'm enthusiastically supportive of it, and it's going to pass. It's going to be on the House floor, I think, next week. It passed the Senate overwhelmingly. And that's not all the bill does. We're streamlining the procurement process, the design and engineering and transitioning that into actual construction. We're streamlining that process so projects can get done faster and less expensively. We're also going to assess an annual fee on people who drive electric vehicles because they're not buying gas. That's how we pay for roads. So if you're driving a Tesla out there, you need to be contributing into the fund. And so that's going to be another revenue source for us. So anyway, I recognize and I get that some people hear choice lanes or toll roads or whatever, but I want to, even if you still disagree with it, I want to make sure you understand what we're doing.
And yeah, it's a good distinction. If you can drive right next to that lane and not pay for it, or you can choose to go into that lane and pay for it, then that is absolutely choice. And that is considered a choice lane, not just a euphemism for toll road. So thank you for the clarification. Okay, this is a controversial one. I don't like it. SB 1109 aimed at codifying the constitutional rights of Tennesseans to decline vaccines for religious reasons in their private sector failed in the Senate Commerce and Labor Subcommittee yesterday. Why did you decide that was a no?
Yeah, no, I could not support that legislation. And let me, first of all, make sure that your viewers and listeners understand, I led the charge in October of 2021 to get us into a special session to fight back against Joe Biden's unconstitutional vaccine mandates for people to get the COVID vaccine shot.
Yes, you did.
And I sponsored that legislation, and we passed one of the most comprehensive, strongest bills to protect people's medical freedoms in the entire nation. And other states used it as a model for their states. I was very proud of Tennessee and that we acted swiftly and decisively to stand up to that. Now, ultimately, the courts sided with us. It was blatantly unconstitutional for a president of the United States via an executive order to say, you have to get a shot. That's ridiculous. Yes, right. And luckily, the courts affirmed that. And we passed legislation saying that no governmental entity, no school, no city, no county, the state, no one could force you to get a vaccine. And then I passed the legislation saying that your employer cannot require you to get this COVID-19 shot. It's an experimental use authorization, and I'm very proud that we got that done. And ultimately, the courts threw out his legislation anyway. 1109 is far different, though. We took care of the COVID. A lot of people think 1109 is dealing with the COVID shot, and it's not. It is all vaccines. It's saying that any employer can, that no employer in the state of Tennessee can require you to get any vaccine. So if you're a healthcare worker working in a pathology lab studying measles virus, and they say, you know what, you're around this deadly virus all day, every day, you got to get a measles vaccine. Now, that's a vaccine that's been around for 60 years. I don't think that the heavy hand of government should step in and say they can't do that. If my wife is battling stage 4 breast cancer and she and I run a small jewelry store and we need to hire a bookkeeper who's going to be around my wife all day and she's immunocompromised, and I say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to get a flu shot. I mean, I know it. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't, but we're going to take every step we can to protect my wife's health. That's my business. That's my property. What about the property rights of the business owner? We've created an environment now where we got more jobs than people. And the last thing I'll say is that this is not a problem. This is a solution in search of a problem. And we've asked. We asked the business community. I've asked people in my community, is anybody out there making people get vaccines? I mean, as a matter of due course? And they're saying no, except in some of those very specific instances I mentioned. If you're a food service company, we did find out that there are some food service where you're preparing food and they make you get a hepatitis vaccine. That's a vaccine that's been around. It's very effective. It's been around for 40 years. And they say, look, you're handling food that could maybe make somebody sick. And so if you want to work here, you're going to have to get a hepatitis vaccine. So it went too far. Tennessee is an at-will employment state, and that's a fundamental part of our economy. And it's one of the reasons, again, people in Tennessee, if you don't like your job, you can walk across the street and probably make more money than you're making now. And you've got a lot of opportunities. So you have to be very careful. I'm all for religious freedoms and personal freedoms. But I'm also going to be respectful of somebody who's put their heart and soul into building a business, a small business. This bill created a private right of action, meaning every trial lawyer in the state would be salivating, waiting to go start slapping lawsuits on every small business owner. You'd see the TV commercials late at night. Has your employer asked you to get vaccinated and you didn't want to? Call 1-800 blah, blah, blah. And then you're going to have lawsuits all over the state. So I appreciated the intent. I just want to make sure your viewers understand this wasn't about COVID. We took care of COVID. I led the charge to do that. This is much broader, and I do think that there could be some very specific limited instances where someone, where an employer would be justified in making someone get a measles vaccine or hepatitis or something like that.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you. House Bill 1109, same number in the Senate, I believe, could criminalize Tennessee parents based on anonymous abuse or neglect allegations. Sounds bad in an era when people online are so vicious and lie, as we talked about earlier. Would you vote for that if the Senate gets it?
You know, that's one I'm not as familiar with, Steve. I'd have to look at it. I have concerns about it because, you know, you mentioned in my introduction, my wife is a judge and she presides over divorce cases. And let me tell you, they say some nasty things about right. each other. And it's sad. And sometimes the kids are involved and everything else. So that's one I'd have to talk to the sponsors and be very specific about what they're trying to accomplish. Sorry, I'm not as familiar with that one.
That's okay. With 3,000 out there, I didn't expect you to have everyone line in verse. But there is a bill to clean up voter rolls of dead people, and it failed in the House subcommittee. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I look across the state and obviously with a lot of focus on election integrity after the 2020 election, I'm proud of Tennessee and the way we conduct our elections, and we should be purging the rolls, and we do that. I'm not sure why that bill did not pass. I know in Williamson County, where I represent, that the county does a really good job of that. And there are some existing requirements in the law that they do that ever so often. But it's something that should be done. And if we need to strengthen that, I'd be supportive of that.
Okay. I got about 5 minutes left with you. I know you're busy. Generally, why does so much money come from outside of people's district versus inside of them and from corporate interests instead of individuals? Just what do you think of that?
You mean in terms of like campaign contributions?
Yeah, yeah. The politicians are getting a lot of their money from outside of their districts.
Well, I don't. That may be true. You know, you have political action commission committees in Tennessee that do make contributions. But I would submit to you that, for example, the Realtors of Tennessee, the Realtors Association, have been very, very supportive of me over the years. We've had a great working relationship, and they do an amazing job. Williamson County, there is a state Realtors PAC, but there are a lot of Realtors in Williamson County that are contributing to that PAC. And their board gets together and they decide which candidates they would like to support. So while it may be a PAC that might be headquartered in Nashville, there are a lot of people who work in that profession that are contributing to that PAC that are constituents of mine. You can say the same thing about doctors or architects. So I don't demonize PACs. I know some do and think that PACs are evil. I think that PACs are a way for people who don't have a tremendous amount of money to be able to make a smaller dollar contribution and have their money pooled with other smaller dollar contributions in order to have a better impact. And so there are a lot of PACs out there that contribute. And some of those PACs might even be headquartered outside the state, but it doesn't mean that people in Tennessee are not contributing to that PAC. So anyway, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. That's a good point.
Individual donors, I don't know how many contributions I've received from people outside of Tennessee, but those PACs, they give an opportunity for someone. You know, there are people out there who can write big dollar checks because they're very wealthy, but I think it's equally as important for people who can't write those big dollar checks to be able to have their voice heard as well.
Okay. Now, you led the charge on reinstating SNAP benefits with a work requirement. I think that was very good. Have you seen good results from that?
We have. And of course, what we've been through over the last, over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, we've seen, you know, we had the strongest economy in the nation in 18-19. Then obviously 20 came and the pandemic and everything, you know, changed and got upset the apple cart. But we're back to 2019 levels in terms of our economy. We clearly know that people, given the opportunity, will abuse that system. And it's very important, and it's a condition of the program that, you know, if you lose your job, you are eligible for certain types of benefits. But a condition of receiving those benefits is that you be actively looking for work or seeking education so that you're more employable. And either of those are good. So I've passed a number of bills over the years to strengthen that and make sure if you're receiving those benefits, you need to be looking for a job.
Okay. I think I have time for one more. Steve will tell me. Social media. The Senate seemed to have moved to 2024, which is an election year, which is not very helpful for free speech. You know, what I do for this, I was going to say for a living, but I don't take any money for this. Under 7% of journalists vote for the GOP, and liberal corporations own the media. I think we agree on that. The Republicans were in the minority here, just like you said, 12 years ago, and for a very long time. Do you think the Republican Party of today is paving the way for a future Democratic majority to return with some of these law changes that I could go down the list, but I think you know what I'm talking about, where the Democrats get more of a benefit from it than the Republicans who are voting for it are getting? For example, the social media, we're treating social media as PACs, let's say that.
I'm not sure I'm following you. Is it a specific bill that you're referring to?
Yeah, the bill that was
anything you said in the terms of the context, but yeah. Is there a bill that you're referring to that got deferred?
There was, and it got deferred to next year, and it was basically to limit the big tech censorship from censoring. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But now they get another year to do it, leading into an election year, and since we know they target conservatives and specifically Republicans everywhere, not just Tennessee, but we are happen to be the most Republican state, it's going to affect Republicans' ability to have free speech, freedom of religion, all the things that we want to do online and in social networking. I would have thought that the Republicans would have defended that as opposed to wait till it's the heat of an election year when the voices are most needed. They didn't do that. So what are your thoughts on that? Maybe you don't have thoughts on that, but I know I phrased that very badly, but
sure. No, I know what you're talking about now, and it's an issue we've wrestled with for the last several years. Because you're right, social media, your Twitters, your Facebooks, and even Google, they were censoring Republicans, censoring conservative viewpoints. They were censoring people who did not parrot the Biden administration's talking points relative to COVID. They censored people who were promoting alternative treatments, and all of that is wrong. And I would love for us to be able to do something about it. And while it's not been legislation that I've sponsored, I know some of the people who have been working on it. And believe me, they are very passionate about getting that done. I don't know that I can give you a detailed explanation of some of the roadblocks that we're running into, but here's one thing I know that we always wrestle with, especially with bills like that. If they're deemed to be unconstitutional by a judge, then we accomplish nothing. And so we can pass all the bills we want, but if somebody shows up at the federal district courthouse filing for an injunction of this law and they get the right judge, the law gets enjoined, it gets stayed, nothing goes into effect. And I believe part of this conversation has been relative to interstate commerce. And that is something that the federal constitution is very clear about. I think the federal government is involved in a lot of things they shouldn't be involved in, but they do have jurisdiction over interstate commerce. And so trying to figure out a way within the border of Tennessee to protect people's viewpoints and prevent them from being censored on social media is a challenge. I'm not saying it can't be done, and there's really smart people, I'm not one of them on this particular issue, that are looking into and trying to figure that out. We know some other states have passed some things that have gotten enjoined, said, no, you can't do that. That's a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. But others have done some things. And so I can't tell you why the sponsor deferred action on it. I can just tell you I'm all for and very supportive of trying to find a solution for that.
Okay, last question then. What are your priorities for the rest of the session?
Well, this is the time when we start focusing on the budget. The governor proposed his budget in a state of the state back earlier in our session. He will be bringing us what we refer to as the administration amendment, or the AA, the budget amendment, which contemplates additional revenue collections that we've had since he gave his State of the State address. And that's really kind of beginning for us to try to land the plane on the budget for the next fiscal year. As majority leader, I'm the sponsor of the budget. So a lot of work going on with our finance committee and getting that finalized. So we should get the governor's amendment in the next couple of weeks. And then we'll start, we always say the governor proposes, but the legislature disposes. So we take his proposed budget and we go through it with a fine-tooth comb and make alterations as we deem necessary. Maybe don't fund some things he wanted to fund or fund some things that we want to fund. And so that'll be the focus of my concern. I've got other things I'm focused on, but my primary focus from now until adjournment will be on getting our budget passed. And I can tell you, it'll be a balanced budget. We'll put more money in our savings account. We're going to continue to cut taxes. We're going to do everything that conservatives believe in, and we're demonstrating every day that they work right here in Tennessee.
That's great. And you and he go to the same church, so you can work on it on weekends too. Senator, thank you for your time and candor. We are at the end here. Please tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about what you're doing, where you are, your social media, anything you want to share.
Sure. Well, all my contact information is easily found. Just Google Senator Jack Johnson. It'll pop right up. And always welcome to contact my office about things you're passionate about. We get lots of emails, lots of phone calls, and we love getting them. And we try to respond to most of them. Sometimes we can't, but so you can contact me there. And then my website is johnsonfortennessee.com. I'm on Facebook and Twitter. So follow me if you're not doing so already. And I really appreciate you having me on.
Great. I hope to have you on again after the session. We can talk about it. Thank you.
I'm James.
I'm Max. And I'm Ginger Stocky.
And we're watching the Mill Creek View Tennessee podcast. I don't understand how you ever did without me.
I don't understand. Welcome to the Steven Speaks segment of our show. I bring you down to your knees. Where we cover what we just heard.
How would you do without me, Steve? How would you do without me?
I don't like to talk over that song because I like to listen to it.
I know. And
sometimes I miss my mark. But what did you think of our guest, Senator Jack Johnson?
Oh, you know, I know your Tennesseans are, most of them are Republican, and they have their views on who's doing what and not doing enough. Steve, I live in Washington State. I pray for individuals like him. Oh, my goodness. If we could just have 10 of those individuals on the west side, we could totally change the state of Washington. But right now, we've got a handful from the eastern side of things. And Steve,
it is funny to hear some of the complaints against the Republican senators and congressmen of Tennessee. And I just remind myself, like, you don't even know. If you had a Jay Inslee on your team, you would be very, very upset. Anyway, Steve, we owe congratulations to Lee Fink from Minnesota, right? Biological male named Minnesota's Woman of the Year.
Oh my gosh.
Fink is carrying a bill in the Minnesota House that would make the state of refuge.
Is that refuse? State of refuge?
Well, it would make the state a refuge for children seeking gender-affirming drugs and surgeries. For that, USA Today named Rep. Lee Fink, a biological male who identifies as a woman, Minnesota's Woman of the Year over the weekend. Quote, I have a future-oriented vision of what the work is, that is how I think of it. I think about what we're doing for our children's sake, for the next generation, for 30 years from now, said Fink, the first transgender lawmaker in the Minnesota House. According to USA Today's profile, Fink has been an activist for transgender and LGBTQ+ rights, as well as Black Lives Matter, almost her whole life. Trans liberation is upward flowing. All liberation movements flow outwards. Everyone will benefit from it, and it's worth committing yourself to, Fink said. But not just Minnesota. Many so-called. America the Beautiful is in on this. White House gives International Women's Day Award to biological man. The Woman of Courage Award was given to Alba Ruda, who serves as the Special Envoy for Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity in Argentina's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. On Wednesday, the Biden White House celebrated International Women's Day by presenting an award to a biological man who believes he is a woman. In Argentina, Alba Ruda is a transgender woman who was kicked out of classrooms, barred from sitting for exams, refused job opportunities, subjected to violence, and rejected by his family, said Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks, as the award was presented to Ruda by Jill Biden and Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Quote, in the face of these challenges, she worked to end violence and discrimination against the LGBTQI+, whatever comes next, community in Argentina. Good job, Alba. So what are we doing to our real girls in this country? Let's listen to clip number one.
Idaho passed its 2020 ban on transgender athletes participating in girls or women's. More than a dozen other states have passed similar laws, while a handful of blue states are doing the exact opposite, enforcing laws that protect the ability of trans people who want to participate in athletic programs consistent with their gender identity, not the sex that they were assigned at birth. Vermont is one of those states. CNN's Bryn Gingras is there, where one private Christian parochial school has been barred from competing in all sports after the girls' basketball team there refused to play against another team that had a transgender athlete.
Vermont, one of the country's most progressive states, publicly debating a controversy involving kids that one state lawmaker says left her with
disappointment in the adults.
It happened in State Senator Rebecca White's district. Mid-Vermont Christian School forfeited a state tournament girls' basketball game because the opposing team had a transgender player on its roster. The school arguing a, quote, very real issue of safety was at play. What followed, a swift and sweeping penalty against the school's athletic program by the state's governing body, the Vermont Principals Association. It banned the high school from all competition in all sports moving forward.
Is that a bridge too far?
No. I don't think it's a bridge too far. The athletes that we're talking about are unlikely to go on to some of the elite professional athletics, but that concept of discriminating against another young person, it causes long-term outcomes for trans youth, because they're hearing rhetoric that is telling them that they're not valuable, that in fact they're dangerous.
State Senator Rebecca White, folks, disappointed in the adults, she said, not going on to the elite level. Okay, one of these days when we have video, I will show you the clip of the volleyball player who identifies as a female but is biological male, who separates the skull from the spinal cord of a young girl on a volleyball court, he is giving the opportunity to be his best self. Mid-Vermont Christian school banned from all sports following their girls' high school basketball team boycotting a tournament game against a team with a trans player for safety reasons. Okay, next. A new PBS documentary, taxpayer-funded, about the good Dr. Fauci is coming out. Let's take a sneak peek. Clip number two.
I thought I would give it to him if I get it.
No, not at all. In fact, we got to get you vaccinated so that if you were to get infected, you could pass it on to them. So you're actually protecting your family by getting it vaccinated.
Well, I heard that it doesn't cure it and it doesn't stop you from getting it.
No.
So
on the very, very, very rare chance that you do get it, even if you're vaccinated, you don't even feel sick. It's like you don't even know you got infected. It's very, very good at protecting you.
Just the Anacostia, so get up there. Okay.
All right, see you later.
Oh my gosh, she's making the rounds, making those rounds.
Yeah. She said, I heard that the COVID vaccine doesn't cure it and it doesn't stop you from getting it. Well, she was right. Dr. Fauci should have listened to the people in the Black community that he was attempting to educate through misinformation. Those people are legitimately tyrannical. In what universe did they think it was okay to go door to door and lie to people in order to get them to take a shot? Stay strong, DC. You are informed. A little more. Clip three, please.
What are we going to do about those other states?
Oh, my God. They're going to keep the outbreak smoldering in the country. It's so crazy. I mean, they're not doing it because they say they don't want to do it. They're Republicans. They don't like to be told what to do.
Right.
And we got to break that, you know, unpack that.
How you guys doing with vaccine?
It's always got to be politics. It can't be somebody's actually very wise in their thinking there, can it?
No. He said we have to break that. Fauci thinks people in red states refuse the C-19 shot due to their politics and values. Based on the video of his interactions with Black people, it seems he believes they decline due to ignorance. I sense a subtle racist subtext here. Let's end on clip number four for the PBS special that is going to air soon. Taxpayer funded.
America are not settled with the information that's been given to us right now.
So I'm not going to be lining up taking a shot on a vaccination for something that wasn't clear in the first place. And then you all create a shot in miraculous time. It takes years to create vaccination.
Well, it used to take years.
Okay, it used to.
You know how many years were invested in this approach? About 20 years of science to get us to be able to do it.
20 years is not enough. And 9 months is definitely not enough for nobody to be taking no vaccination that you all came up with.
The only reason I'm talking to you right now, as close as we are, is that I've been vaccinated.
Right.
But if it allow thousands of people like you don't get vaccinated, you're going to let this virus continue to percolate in this country and in this world.
Something like the common flu then, right?
It's much more serious than the flu.
Though.
Well, the flu kills a lot of people annually, too.
You know how many people died of the flu the last year? I mean, not this year, virtually none, but the previous year, about 20 to 30,000. You know how many people have died from COVID-19 in the United States? 600,000 Americans.
The number that you all given that died, that's once again, that's you all's number.
You gonna pass.
Yeah, definitely. Because when you start talking about paying people to get vaccinated, when you start talking about incentivizing things to get people vaccinated, there's something else going on with that. Something else going on.
You're right. But I'm glad millions of people like me and most everybody here didn't get an incentive. You know what their incentive was? Protecting their health and protecting the city. But I won't keep you anymore.
It's okay, because my incentive, y'all campaign is about fear. It's about inciting fear in people. You all attack people with fear.
There we go.
That's what this pandemic is. It's a fear. It's fear, this pandemic. That's all
it is. Yes, sir. Fauci took his big bag of bullshit to the D.C. neighborhood to persuade residents to get the mRNA shots and get his tushy handed to him. The man really speaks the truth, and sad-looking D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser tried to guilt him into the shot, basically telling him he's a bad person. Disgusting. All right, next. Rhode Island School District blocks Christian Club from holding after-school meetings. The Providence Public School District, PPSD, is being sued in federal court for refusing to allow a Christian club to hold after-school meetings on school property. According to the complaint, for 2 years, the district has ignored multiple applications from the plaintiff, the Child Evangelism Fellowship of Rhode Island, to allow a local chapter of its Good News Club to meet at school once a week immediately after dismissal. Not very nice. Here's nice. Arkansas enacts law to protect rights of girls to female-only spaces in public schools. Arkansas is the latest state to protect the rights of schoolgirls to the privacy and safety of female-only restrooms and changing rooms. Arkansas became the fourth state to enact laws to protect female-only spaces in public schools. Alabama, Oklahoma, and good old Tennessee. That's nice. The press secretary for Biden hasn't been very nice to a reporter from Africa. Check this out. Clip number five.
You can't keep discriminating against some people in the briefing room because you don't like them, you don't like them.
So you have a choice. No, you have a choice. You have a choice.
A number of people okay. In the briefing room, and I'm saying that that's not right. This is not China. This is not Russia. This is the United States. This is the White House. It's been 7 months. I sent you
some of the rest of us are here too, pal.
It's been 7 months. You guys have not done anything for me.
If you have grievances, you should bring them to her later.
I have done that. I have done that. All my emails have been ignored.
And the press corps is tired of dealing with this.
It isn't just about you, Simon.
I understand that you get questioned all the time and you don't understand what it is to sit here for 8 months and being discriminated against. I understand that you're in the front row and you feel comfortable and you get questioned all the time. But there are people in the back who don't get any questions.
Don't make assumptions about what the rest of us do. Mind your manners when you're in here. If you have a problem, you bring it up afterwards. But you are impinging on everybody in here who's only trying to do their job.
Okay, sorry. Thank you. I'm saying that you shouldn't discriminate against some people because you don't agree with their question. You're offended by your question.
Major point. Major point. We all heard it.
All right. Guys, as you all know, many of you know, this is the White House press briefing room, a historic room, a room that should have decorum, a room where folks should respect their colleagues and respect the guests that are here. And I understand that there's going to be give and take. That's the way the press briefing has gone for decades before me. And I will always, always respect that. But what I will not appreciate is disrespecting your colleagues and disrespecting guests who were here to talk about an incredibly important issue, which is mental health. And what has just occurred this last 10, 15 minutes is unacceptable. It is unacceptable. So we're either going to continue the briefing, or we can just end the briefing right here. No. Okay. Well, then let's go.
That was Simon Atiba of Today News Africa interrupts the White House press briefing again and is shouted down by other reporters. "Quote: You are implying you are impinging on everybody in here who's only trying to do their jobs." A little bit of mansplaining, whatever. He'll be here if all goes according to plan on the Mill Creek View podcast April 6th.
Ooh.
So stay for that. Okay, another update to College March Madness, although it's year-round madness. That wacky Stanford Law diversity and inclusion lady that yelled at the judge I played for y'all last week is now on leave. Tyrion Steinbach, associate dean, is the juice worth the squeeze, she said, questioning the judge's speech worth the pain and division to law students. Stanford president issued an apology to Judge Duncan. Okay, bye-bye, Tyrion. Average salary of an associate dean at Stanford is $94,680. Ouch. Hope it was worth the squeeze for you too, dear. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. Welcome to my last quotes for the week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View Podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify or iTunes and hit the subscribe button and follow us. While you're there, go ahead and leave a comment. and thanks for doing it. I have never understood why it is greed to want to keep the money you have earned, but not greed to want to take somebody else's money. When you want to help people, you tell them the truth. When you want to help yourself, you tell them what they want to hear. People who pride themselves on their complexity and deride others for being simplistic should realize that the truth is often not very complicated. What gets complex is evading the truth. Last one, the problem isn't that Johnny can't read. The problem isn't even that Johnny can't think. The problem is that Johnny doesn't know what thinking is. He confuses it with feelings. Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell is an American author, economist, social theorist, and political commentator who is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, Stanford, with widely published commentary and books, and as a guest on TV and radio, he became a well-known voice in the American conservative movement and is considered one of the most influential Black conservatives. That's it for this episode. Really hoped you like it. Thank you, Jack Johnson, for keeping Tennessee, Tennessee, or as best you can. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of mcview.us. Peace in our time.
Children and the pumpkins at the county fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so many love to burn. I'll cruise the countryside with my dad and my brother, row after row of cotton and corn, moving through this place just like rolling thunder. Lord, I love the land where I was born.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.